This episode is brought to you by Palvit Relief. Born out of necessity, Palvit Relief was founded by mother of three, Eleanor Gardner, for all of those who discovered they could not access quality products and information to manage conditions such as pelvic pain, incontinence, and painful sex. Led by science and quality, Palvit Relief have brought together best-in-class products for pelvic relief, including sole-source silicon and DRS dilators, O-Nut, EVB support wear, period and incontinence pants, EZ Magic, and yes, lubricants and moisturisers. Gronya and I highly recommend Palvit Relief, frequently referring our patients to purchase quality products, knowing they will receive a quality service. To visit the website, visit www.palvitrelief.co.uk. Thank you so much, Palvit Relief, for sponsoring At Your Cervix podcast season 2. This is At Your Cervix, the podcast where pelvic health physiotherapist Emma Brockwell and Gronya Donnelly talk to incredible guests who help lift the lid and bust the myth on all things pelvic health. Hello and welcome back to season 2, episode 3 of At Your Cervix, the podcast. We really hope you've enjoyed listening to episodes 1 and 2 as much as we have enjoyed recording them. On today's episode, we talk to fitness professional and pregnancy and postpartum athleticism coach, Inemisit Graham. We talked to her today about her experience of navigating her body image as a Black woman, perceptions of the ideal body, and how modern medicine was influenced heavily by racism, misogyny, by the slave trade, eugenics, and the normalisation of whiteness and the otherings of Blackness. We also discuss the diastasis journey and colonisation of fitness. This is a great one. We really hope you enjoy it.
Hi everyone, it's Gronya from At Your Cervix, the podcast. Before we introduce today's guests and get stuck in, I want to remind you all that in season 1, we spoke to Ilian Morrison, who is a midwife and birth trauma specialist. Ilian regularly highlights and educates about racial inequalities in healthcare. And today we wish to build upon that conversation and delve deeper and gain wider perspectives. Who better to gain this from than fitness professional and pregnancy and postpartum athleticism coach, Inemisit Graham. Inemisit was born in Nigeria, moving to England when she was 5 years old, and she currently resides in Canada, where she has been for the last 13 plus years. She is the founder of Mommy Fitness, an online perinatal fitness platform, and her passion for health and fitness stems from her own struggles of understanding her body. Body image issues trace back to early childhood when Inemisit moved to the UK, and this highlights the societal expectations and constructs created within our Western world. Her journey into motherhood further challenged these body image expectations, and the more Inemisit began to learn and understand about her body, the less she disliked it. She's now a voice of self-appreciation and racial equality, and she inspires women all around the world. Her goal is to offer a decolonized approach to fitness based on body liberty and not body oppression. We are delighted to have you here today, Inemisit, to learn from you. Can you begin by telling us a little bit more about yourself and discuss your earlier memories of the change in body image that occurred when you moved from Nigeria to the UK?
Yeah, it's great to be on here, Graham. Thanks for having me. I moved from Nigeria to England when I was 5. My dad is a gynecologist that worked locum, and he got a position in an English hospital. And I'd been going to school in Nigeria for about a year. In Nigeria, you can put your child in school as soon as they start talking. So I'd been in school since I was 3. And then I started first year 1 in school in England. And that was the first time that I really experienced bullying that I can remember, was going to school in England. And I had been born with, now as an adult, I know it was a large umbilical hernia. I didn't understand it as a child. I just thought my belly button protruded, and you could see my belly button protruding through my clothes, like the hernia bulge, maybe 2 or 3 inches outside of my body. So you could see it through clothes, but it's nothing that I'd ever been self-conscious about. It's nothing that I'd ever thought anything about until I started being bullied about my body at school. And so when I was six, my parents opted to have, to allow me to have surgery to remove, to change the way that the hernia looked, to close the hernia so my belly would appear differently. And when I asked my mom as an adult why she allowed me to have surgery when the hernia wasn't problematic, it was just about my body image issues. She said that at the time I'd stop refusing to undress in front of everyone, including herself. Mm-hmm. And she was worried that if they didn't address the issues, that it would be something that followed me my whole life, which now I think about it and I find it kind of ironic because I guess, I mean, it has followed me my whole life regardless, but yeah, it was in school in year one that I first became aware that my body was different and I started feeling a need to hide it from other people.
Oh gosh, that's horrible, isn't it? And do you think, so when you were in school in Nigeria, that you weren't getting that response from the kids there. You would, that was never flagged to you. It was only when you came over to the UK that approach towards your body changed. And do you think that's a cultural thing? Do you think that's something that was there inbred within the children in the UK?
Yeah, it wasn't flagged to me. And it's like, I'll write that I've been self-conscious about the hernia my whole life. But when I truly think about it, I have been self-conscious about the hernia since I moved to England. Right. And I think the kids just had a simple awareness. Kids notice difference. And so I was very different to the kids there. And when I moved to County Norfolk, England, which was dubbed the England's last white county, it was I went into the school that I entered. I was the only Black student there. I was probably the only Black student my peers had associated with. So I came in as this, I guess, quote unquote, straight off the boat, Black girl from Africa that had a heavy Nigerian accent that didn't speak English well. So I looked physically different. And then I had this hernia, this thing. So everything about me was different to the children, and children just point out what's different to them. And so then I became aware that nobody else looked like me. And so when I was going to school in Nigeria, everyone looked like me. So I wasn't aware that I was different. Also with the hernia experience as an adult, now I know when my mum has an outy belly button, a small umbilical hernia. My younger sister has one. My cousin had one. And so when I look at my family, it existed within my family. So it wasn't something I flagged in my mind as abnormal, but it wasn't something that was common within the English children that I was going to school with. So it's something that they flagged as abnormal and something that they pointed out to me.
And were you symptomatic? Did you have any pain or any issues, or was this purely for aesthetics, essentially, that you had surgery?
It was purely for aesthetics. I've never been symptomatic at all. And the stories I hear from my grandmother, who was born and raised in a Nigerian village. She was there till she was 70, until she moved to the States to be with her children after retirement. But she was in Nigeria when I had the surgery, and my dad had told her that they got surgery for the hernia after the fact. And my mom told me that she was very angry about it, and she didn't understand why I had been given surgery. And she had told my parents that it was normal and it would have corrected itself as I grew up. And something that my mom even told me as a kid, and I kind of dismissed in this idea, like, she doesn't know, she doesn't understand. But as a 35-year-old now, what I do know, and the research I've seen, is that umbilical hernias that happen as adolescents, when children are born with it, most of them will reduce in size or completely resolve within their first 10 years of life. I had my surgery when I was six, so there's a good chance my body was still developing, my body was still immature, and maybe it would have presented differently had there not been any intervention. But outside of that, even when the hernia remains, like now, I still have the hernia. It reopened within several months of the surgery. And so it still exists to this day. So I have the hernia, and then I have the surgery scars, and I have the scar tissue, but it's still asymptomatic. It's still not problematic. And my whole life, the only thing that has ever bothered me about it was its appearance and not having what I had been led to believe was the normal appearance of a belly. And so when I had my children, I was going through my postpartum journey. It was sometimes all on social media, you kind of see this, women become startled because their body changes so dramatically, and it becomes a really hard issue to accept these new changes or embrace these new changes, but I feel like I've been working, I had a bit of a head start, I've been working so much longer to try and embrace my body that when I had all the things associated with postpartum, with the diastasis or the loose skin or the stretch marks, it was just kind of something else to add to everything else that I'd been dealing with around my belly.
I think that's so interesting that you experienced body image issues so young, because we often associate it in women with transitional stages. So even puberty is when women will first, or young girls will start to become a bit body conscious. And then obviously, as you mentioned, the perinatal stage of life because of the changes that are brought about. But it's really evident that this is nearly an awareness and educational issue. And funny, in one of the recent blogs I read that you wrote, I thought it was really, really good. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's called What is Normal? You outline the physiological differences between people from different heritages. And can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because as you said, being the only or maybe the first Black person to arrive in the village that you arrived in when you came to the UK, you felt that, you knew that, because it was nearly that people were unaware and they'd never met someone from your background. Which I find baffling in this day and age to even hear that this has been an experience. But can you tell us a little bit more about that and even some of the differences that we know exist between, say, someone from Black origin, someone from white origin?
Yeah, a lot of my life, I feel like I've been struggling to feel like I fit in. I've always felt like this sore thumb because I felt like I existed outside of what was normal. And now as an adult, I'm understanding that what was considered normal has been represented as normal in society wasn't set up to include me. Mm-hmm. And I can take it from like just small things that we absorb as children. So when we talk about racism, it's nobody's teaching children. Most people aren't teaching children that Black is bad and white is good. But this is a message we absorb from the stories that we hear. And so I'll think of something like stories like the ugly duckling, where they talk about the ugly brown duckling and who becomes a beautiful white swan after this journey. And for a girl that's born in a brown skin, when you're hearing the word ugly and brown put together, it's difficult not to associate it with yourself. As growing up, I grew up on Disney. Like a lot of girls, I watched the Disney movies about the Disney princesses, and you hear the stories of like Snow White, and she's soft and feminine and needs to be rescued, and Sleeping Beauty, and all these white damsels that have these heroes come and save them. And throughout most of my childhood, there were no like Black princesses. So that's another thing where we're not telling children that white girls are princesses and Black girls can't fit that aesthetic. But when that representation is not shown, that's the message that's being given. And then in Disney, I remember the first Black princess to be introduced, Tiana, in The Princess and the Frog. I was very excited about, because I was like, oh, a princess that looks like me. But that movie was problematic because in the 90 minutes that the movie ran, Tiana appeared as a frog for like over 70 minutes of it. She's only actually appears as a Black girl for 17 minutes of the 90 minute movie. And so that's another thing where the message was that it was more acceptable, more palatable for Disney to make a movie about a green frog than to make a movie starring a Black girl with African features. And so there's these kind of insidious messaging that we get. And even in our language is built about differentiating between Black and white. And we look at the things we use commonly, things that are negative, like blacklist and blackmail and black sheep. And then we look at the innocence of whiteness. When we talk about a white lie is a less harmful lie than a regular lie. White magic is thought of as good magic versus Black magic, which is thought as evil magic. So there's all these associations between Black and white that you absorb. And as a child, I wasn't able to make sense of that. I could feel like I felt like I lived in a world that wasn't set out for me, a world that I wasn't represented in a positive light, and I didn't feel good about myself. It was hard for me to separate those messages. And then going through personal training, I remember my first personal training course, all the students had to assess each other, and we're basing it on a picture in a textbook, and the picture suggested that somebody that had a deeper dip in their hips had a pelvic tilt. I remember someone assessing me and saying, oh, you have an anterior pelvic tilt because of the way that your butt looks. And in, I responded to them, I'm like, well, that's how my mom's butt is. That's how my auntie's butt is. And just realizing that this textbook isn't made according to the figures of the women in my family.
Yeah.
And through a discussion on social media, I was talking about just some of those physiological differences that aren't taken into account. And one thing is that even today, women, Black women have a much higher rate of C-section than white women, and they're more likely to be recommended a C-section. And his, one of the things that contributed to that historically was that women of African heritage, it was found that their pelvis, they tended to have a more anthropoid pelvis, which meant that the pelvis was longer from the front to back, versus women of European heritage tended to have a pelvis that presented more of gynecoid, which was a more heart-shaped pelvis. Mm-hmm. 20th century doctors believed that the gynecoid presentation was normal because that's what they'd seen in the women that they treated. And they believed that this kind of presentation was more favorable to have a vaginal delivery. So they came across women of African heritage that didn't have the same dimensions. And they started seeing that the anthropoid pelvis facilitated a more sunny side birth. The belief was that Black women would be unable to deliver babies naturally because their pelvises would present the same as white women. And so Black women were being given C-sections that may not have been necessary. There's other things like nutritionally, there was a belief for a long time that Black women had nutritionally poor babies. It was found that enslaved women and women of African heritage tended to have babies of lower birth weight from around 5 to 7 pounds. And anecdotally, my mom says, when I was born, I was 5.5 pounds. My three other sisters were between 5 and 6 pounds. None of us reached 7 pounds, but we're all healthy babies. Mm-hmm. But now today that we know that women of African origin are more likely to have babies of lower birth weight, but this is a common physiological trait, but those babies are just as healthy as the higher birth weight babies that are more commonly associated with women of European heritage. And so it's like noting that there are differences according to heritage and ethnicity, but these differences don't make one group normal and one group abnormal. It's just the variation of humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so uncomfortable to listen and hear what you are talking about, which is, you know, entirely makes sense, and also quite uncomfortable when you bring it up. And I think, my goodness, I've never even thought of it like black magic, white magic. I've never put it into that context before because I guess I've never had to. Whereas you are constantly surrounded by that negativity. It must be so difficult but maddening as well. Doesn't it make you angry and furious that in the 21st century we're still having these sorts of conversations?
Yes and no. It's funny because it's like you whatever you grew up with is normal to you, and so there's a part that I grew up like accepting that maybe that I didn't fit the narrative, or maybe that, it's kind of hard to explain. I think it's hard to get angry when sometimes you feel like, in my position, it's almost like you feel like you're gaslighted sometimes until you start speaking to other people that have the same experience. And my sister had a conversation where she says, my husband is white, my son's a biracial, my sister's husband is white, her children are biracial. And she was talking about her oldest, her son, having only white friends. And she talked to him about it, saying that she thinks she encourages him to also make some black friends. And he didn't really understand why she was saying that. And she said, it's not that, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with having white friends. I think like your friends are your friends. I'm saying that it's important to also have black friends in order to, when you experience certain things in life that your white friends don't understand, you have somebody else to speak to that can reflect those experiences back at you so that you don't feel like you're going crazy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I find like my white friends, although well-meaning, because they don't have the same experience of life, they can unintentionally gaslight you. And that's what I've discovered as an adult. It's important to also have black friends and friends, brown friends, and people that have experienced life differently to my white friends. So I don't feel like my experiences aren't valid. And there's a small example in high school in England. It's been recently a message was recently sent to schools that if there are racial slurs in textbooks, that the teachers shouldn't read it. Growing up through school, that wasn't something that was enforced. It was just taught as part of history. And so I've been in a class in all my schooling life. I was the only Black student in class. So I was in a class in high school where they were reading a book that had referred to Black people as the N-word, and it kept saying it over and over again in the textbook. And the teacher encouraged the other students to read it because that was the text, and that was the teacher said that that was part of understanding the text and the language of the time. And so the students would go around, the white students reading it, and even those that felt uncomfortable, the teacher would encourage them to say it. And so later I was having a discussion with a friend saying how completely uncomfortable I felt in that class, that I didn't want to be there. And she was a white friend, and she said, well, it was just in the textbook, like it wasn't meant as you, it was just like the history of it. And it was like, she didn't fully understand my feelings in that moment, because she's in a white classroom in a white society, in a society where she sees herself represented everywhere. Whereas I'm existing in a society where I'm the minority, where I'm the other, where these words are powerful. I know the history of these words. I know I've had those words screamed at me hatefully. And so even having children read it in a classroom where I'm the only Black student, it's extremely uncomfortable and extremely unpleasant for me, but she couldn't understand that. And it was only speaking to other Black people, speaking to my sisters, that they could understand almost the horror of it. Not saying that anyone can't understand that, but I'm just saying that sometimes when you are a minority and you're surrounded by people that don't have the same lived experience as you, they don't always understand. And so it wasn't from a place that I was angry with the world. It was a place that I was angry with myself, because I felt like I was wrong for experiencing the world this way, versus growing up as an adult and realizing just the history of the world and the messaging that we've been put. And the problem wasn't me, the problem was the society and the messaging that we've been taught and the way that this has been used to promote certain agendas, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And so we see it in education, we definitely see it in healthcare, these this systemic racism, the Black Lives Matter campaign, which was last year now, has highlighted a lot of the issues. I don't know if you're aware of the Embrace report that was released in the UK. It's a report on maternal deaths, and it highlighted within that was that Black women are four times more likely to die during and after pregnancy, or the 6 weeks after pregnancy. And there's been some incredible voices like the five times more campaign group. Again, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that campaign group, but they've really gone on to highlight the need for change, the need for research as to why this is happening. But I just wonder if you can perhaps give us any idea of the disparities that you've heard of or that you've experienced within healthcare, perhaps through your perinatal journey, that perhaps someone like myself or Gronya wouldn't have necessarily experienced during or after our childbirth.
Yeah, it's kind of the, because some of this information is putting it into context. So an experience of when I was in labor with my second son, I went in, I'd had an epidural with my first, and I went in with my second with the mindset that I wanted another epidural. And so when I went into labor and I requested one, the second I went in, and the nurse, she said, she gave me other suggestions, try this. Then she came back like 3 minutes later and I requested the epidural again. I remember her looking at me and saying, oh, you don't seem like you're in that much pain. Why don't you try this other thing? And I kept requesting it. And eventually it was a point that she said, oh, you're too far dilated. You can't have an epidural. And in that moment, I was like, Max, I've been asking for this for the past 6 hours and I never got it. But leaving that incident, I had the baby. I forgot about it. I didn't really think much of it after that, until kind of coming back and learning the history of gynecology and learning that my experience wasn't an isolated one. And so like modern gynecology as we know it came out of Dr. Marion Sims, is known as, is called the father of modern gynecology. In the 18th century, he started experimenting on enslaved Black women. And so he had had enslaved Black women that he would experiment with, not without using anesthesia. And anesthesia was available at the time of his experimentations. But his belief was that Black people had thicker skin and these Black women didn't experience pain in the same way as white women. And so he justified not giving them anesthesia. And his medical textbooks, he writes about that. And there's illustrations in his textbooks having these women lying passively on a table where while he operates on them. But the other accounts from the doctors that work with him and from his interns was that the women weren't lying that down passively. They had to be held down forcibly by four or five other people while they screamed in agony while these operations were being done. And lots of the medical interns left because they couldn't handle the horror of the operating room. But those myths that he wrote into medical textbooks that were used to teach other students, and along with the formation of eugenics in the 19th and 20th century, which was this science to find superior traits, which of course the superior traits were linked to white people. And so today, those things still run through in medicine today, and research in the proceedings of the National Academies of Science shows that 40% of first and second year medical students endorse the belief that Black people's skin is thicker than white people. In a 2016 study, it was shown that trainees who believe that Black people are not as sensitive to pain as white people were less likely to treat Black people's pain appropriately. Then we have a 2012 study that found a correlation between a pediatrician's implicit racial biases and how they treated pain in simulated Black and white teenagers following surgery. And that showed that the strength of the provider's implicit bias favoring white people increased the likelihood of prescribing appropriate pain medication to white people, but this decreased for Black people. A more recent study, a 2019 study, that asked subjects to identify pain expressed in photos found that white participants more readily recognize pain on the faces of white people than they recognize pain on the faces of Black people. Then there's a 20-year meta-analysis study that covered sources of pain in numerous settings, and it found that Black patients were 22% less likely than white patients to receive any pain medication at all. And so it's like these false narratives that were built into medicine to support vile abuses are still running through, because our textbooks were written by white doctors. Yeah. Like modern medicine textbooks have been written by white doctors doing experimentations on enslaved Black people in order to forward white health. So Black people, it's ironic that they were used as the source of information, as the source to treat white pain, but those Black bodies were also othered in that. So like when I look at things like that, I might look at my experience in isolation and not think much of it, but when I look at it within context, I'm like, I did request pain medication, I wasn't given it, and I see that this fits into how Black women are treated. And so it makes me question that experience more, and it makes me question why a white nurse looked at me and said that I didn't seem in so much pain, whereas going through labor, like that was the most pain at that point that I've ever experienced in my whole life, and I don't know how else I would have expressed pain to her. But looking at this, the research that has been done, clearly she didn't recognize pain when I expressed it to her. And that's when I think, when we talk about racism, I don't believe that she walked into the room and saw there's a Black woman in labor and I'm not going to give her pain medication. It's not that obvious, it's not that malicious, but that's when we start questioning, like, what are assumptions when we see other people? Why do we assume these things? There's been things shown in medicine that some medical schools will still teach to use different size needles according to race, which stems back to this idea that Black people have thicker skin than white people, so Black people need a bigger needle to give the same medication than white people, which is a completely false narrative.
I think actually what you are mentioning there fits with what Ilian discussed with us in season one, and it's that unconscious bias. It's nearly that she was saying how, you know, systemic racism is still present in the health system, and I was, say, you know, I challenged at that point and was like, but sure, like when I think of the multidisciplinary teams I worked in the hospital, they were very diverse in terms of the staffing. And it came up that even within that, even people who represent the minorities are biased because of the societal background. They don't even realize some of the societal behaviors that are then becoming part of the way that are just being unconscious and just going on. So it's like Emma says, it's really disturbing to hear that. It gives me the shivers to realize the way people are being treated, and that certainly in this day and age that things like that can happen. I think one of the things I really found interesting was you highlighted that when it comes to differentiating and defining races, that even the term Caucasian, I didn't realize where it originated from. That was a huge eye-opener to me. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that in a minute?
Yeah, so like, I mean, race is a social construct. What they've seen, like there is biologically the difference between like a person whose skin is black and a person whose skin is dark, or a person whose skin is dark and a person whose skin is light, is like, so it's like less than 1% of your DNA that actually determines that. And so like this idea of, some people think of Caucasian as the scientific word for race, but it's not at all. It's just another made up term. Caucasian was a term made up by a German scientist in the time of eugenics. And it was from his own personal belief. He was a collector of scars, and he had about 400 scars in his collection. And lots of the scars he'd collected from the Caucasus Mountains, which are in the Germany area. And so from all the scars he'd collected, he decided that the ones in the Caucasus Mountains were much more beautiful than the few African scars that he'd had. And so from that, he claimed that the Caucasus people, the people of the Caucasus Mountains, the Caucasians, were the most beautiful people in the world. And so that's kind of where this idea of Caucasian came from the people that lived in this area of Europe that the mountains ran from. It's not scientific at all. There's no like, Caucasian isn't a scientific word. It isn't a real word. There's no way to trace it back genetically. And white supremacists, in the true form of the people that join groups like that, will use that to look at racial purity. But it's not a thing. It's actually a term based on like bigotry, based on this idea of beauty and this idea of superiority rather than anything else.
It's awful. It shouldn't be used. It just shouldn't be used. I was amazed when I read that in your blog.
And it's used in forms throughout if I think about filling out forms throughout the world, like online. If there is any where they're collecting any sort of demographic information, drop down box, you select, you know what I mean? Like that's term that's used. Like that's crazy.
So it's thought to be more scientific than white, but white is actually more probably it's more accurate when you're describing people.
You said your dad's a gynecologist, did you say?
Yeah.
How does this sit with him when it comes to him treating women in Canada? Is he Canada? Is he in Nigeria?
He's in Nigeria now, but he worked in the UK.
Oh, he did work in the UK. So how did it sit with him working in the UK, with all of these biases and this racial inequality in the hospitals? Was he ever aware of it? Was it something that he ever commented on or
Yeah, I didn't understand as a child. Like, he actually ended up leaving England to go back to Nigeria to practice, because he worked in England for 10 years for 15 years. And his goal at the time was to become a consultant. Yeah. And so he would do locum, and he'd work 6-10 weeks at a time per hospital. And every place he ever did locum invited him back. He was a respected doctor, but he never, every time he applied for a consultantship, he didn't get it. I remember him becoming frustrated about that. And he eventually decided, he said, I'm going to move back to Nigeria because I'm not going to get the promotion here. And now as an adult, I understand he'd worked in an all-white hospital as a black physician. And as an adult now, I kind of understand. I wonder like what were the chances that they were going to promote a black doctor over all these white doctors, and understanding that he must have faced a lot of challenges, knowing mm-hmm. that his worth wasn't being seen and he wasn't going to get the position that he wanted because of his skin. And he actually, like, when people don't go back to Africa, that's what he did, because he didn't see the English medical system giving him a fair chance. Yeah. It's like, speaking of Black doctors, the research has shown, and I guess it's just the ability to see humanity in people, because I don't think a lot of people come planning to treat people differently, but it's, so I talk about representation matters, because when we don't see people in different fields, we don't see the softness of everybody. Like, we'll look at TV and we'll see white people in roles where they're the hero, in roles where they're the villain, in roles where they're popular, in roles where they're not, roles where they're pious, in roles where they're evil. Like, they fit, they can be anything, they fit every role. And so you don't stereotype them into one, like, white people are one way, but we think the way that Black people are represented, like, even I said, the Black girl is not the princess, they're not represented as soft. A few years ago there was the Hunger Games, and one of the characters there, it was a young girl, and in the book she'd been written as, she was like innocent, sweet, very nice, and in the movie she's one of the first girls that get the worst characters that gets killed during the Hunger Games. It's meant to be very tragic, but when it was a mixed race girl that was cast, biracial girl with brown skin, and when she was cast for the role, a lot of people took issue with that because they didn't believe that she could represent innocence, and the expectation was that it would be a blonde girl with blue eyes, something that people associate with softness, because they didn't associate a Black girl with softness. And so we look at things, the associations that we make in our mind, and the research has shown that when Black babies are four times more likely to die than white babies before their first year of life, except when they're treated by a Black doctor. Black women are more likely to die as a result of childbirth, except when they're treated by a Black doctor. And I don't think the exception is because existing in a Black body, you see the humanity of Blackness, but existing outside of Blackness, when our society represents Blackness in a certain way, you might not see the humanity of it. And even like talking about things, like I've had friends, close friends, white friends tell me that, a very close white friend told me that she wished that she was Black growing up, because Black women are so strong and Black women are so beautiful. And it was this idea in her head that might even link back to this, how we treat them, how we see pain. Like, Black women are strong. And like I told her, Black women are no more stronger than white women. And her growing up Black wouldn't have made her stronger than she is now. And just kind of this belief that she had in her head, rather than just seeing like Black women can be anything, like white women can be anything. And there's a quote that's by, I can't remember who it's by, maybe Audre Lorde, that says, surviving something basically isn't the same as being transformed by it. So looking at Black women as strong because they can endure persecution is not the same as being changed by this persecution.
It's a hard listen, isn't it? It really is. I want to just, if it's all right, shift the conversation slightly to your personal experience with diastasis. And would you tell us a little bit about that and the journey that it's taken you on so far to date?
Yeah, so when after my second son, my body changed. Like, I've always been naturally skinny my whole life, naturally slim. So as far as I saw health and fitness and exercise, it was all about weight loss. And so I saw like people exercise because they want to lose weight, and being naturally slender, it wasn't something that particularly appealed to me. Then when I had my second son, I obviously gained weight as a result of a pregnancy, and then my belly was distended. And at the time I associated that distension with just being overweight. And so I'm like, I'll do what everybody else does, and I'll go on a diet. And I saw all the snapback messages, or the lose the baby weight messages. And so I went on a strict diet, and I went from 130 pounds down to 90 pounds. And at 5'7", 90 pounds was like the lowest weight I'd ever been. And I looked pretty emaciated, but my belly still distended. And that was the first time that in my head I thought, well, maybe this isn't about me being overweight, this isn't about fat. And I started joining social media groups, and I would post pictures of me doing a plank. That was the one that got attention. And I posted a picture and I said, does anyone else's belly look like this when they plank? And it just like dipped down the center. And that was the same first time someone had mentioned the word diastasis recti to me. So I Googled it and I found images of all these bellies that look just like mine. And then you get all the warnings that come along with it. And so then I started realize all the things I'd been doing to get like a flat belly, like crunches and sit-ups and all the ab exercises, all the information was telling me not to do it. And so then I started, that was the first time I really started feeling broken, because I assumed like my body has changed because I've had a baby. I understood that and I accepted that to an extent. But then when I discovered I had diastasis, my mindset was, oh, my body is now broken because I have a baby. And that was very discouraging. And I would, I remember I did several programs that claimed that they would fix the diastasis and close the gap. And I became very frustrated with them because I didn't enjoy them at all. And I was complaining to my friend one day that I've been exercising for months and I don't enjoy it and I'm not seeing any results. And she was somebody that just liked to go to the gym and lift weights. She'd been doing it since she was 14. And she just suggested, she said, well, if you don't like what you're doing, you can always come to the gym with me. And at that point, I just kind of felt like I had really nothing to lose. So I was like, why not? And going to the gym with her and training with her was the first time that I actually enjoyed the exercise. And so I started going back with her. And then the power of exercising with her is that she only knew what she knew. She knew what she could do for her body, but she didn't have all this extra information. She didn't have information to tell me not to do stuff or to tell me to be afraid of something. So it gave me the, because no one was telling me not to, I just tried. And when I tried to do stuff, I got better at it and I got stronger at it. And that was the first time that I stopped feeling like I was incapable and I was broken. And even though my belly didn't look the way I wanted to, I discovered that I had strength that I didn't have before my pregnancies. I was able to do things I couldn't do before my pregnancies. And I started realizing that the way that I trained affected my ability. And that was the first time that I didn't feel as trapped in my body. But then over the years, I did still avoid certain things because I didn't want to break myself. But then over the years, I joined a different gym. So I joined a group fitness gym, and they would have, it was a CrossFit style gym, and they'd have group workouts and they put it on the board, and they'd always have things like twisting moments or movements or crunchy movements every once in a while that I did other things. And after a while, I wanted to do what everyone else was doing. I wanted to do the board workouts. I wanted to have my name on the board if I completed the workout in a certain time. And it was at that time that I started trying to find out if, despite the fact I had diastasis, if there was a way that I could learn to do different kinds of movements. And through social media, I came across Anthony Lowe. I took some of his courses, the Physio Detective. I went to one of his live courses, and that was the first time I really discovered that my limitations weren't my body. It was my training. It was my strategies. There's a quote by a Greek philosopher, Kylikas, that says, "We don't rise to our expectations. We fall to our training." And that's what I really discovered, that your body is a result of your training and your strategies, and that the way that it looks, your aesthetics don't determine your athletic.
I've seen that quote before and I was like, yes, I've seen you coined it before. But the message that you're putting out there is one we hear many, many times. And gosh, like I suppose I do a lot in the world in terms of treating and educating and now researching in terms of diastasis. And when I look through the journey of what it was like when I came out of uni, because we got very little education on diastasis as a topic, and it was so restrictive. It was all about do's and don'ts. And the irony of it is, when we consider that we were telling women at one stage not to do certain movements like crunches or twists, and they're going home and they have a baby and they're crunching and twisting as part of their daily life several times a day. So the sensible part of our brain, thankfully science has moved on, and we now know that we actually just need to make women strong for the tasks that they need to be able to do. And like any area of rehabilitation, you restore complete function. So you restore all the movements, you restore all the strength. So I'm glad that you managed to come across Anthony, because he's doing fantastic work in this field. And he's a great advocate. But is there any link that you would have in terms of your body image that you remember from your early childhood to the body image, perhaps expectations that there are in that snapback era of life after having a baby? Like, were these feelings familiar? Did it bring stuff back up? Did it, or were you more resilient to that because of your past experience with the hernia?
It did bring stuff up, but it kind of almost, the diastasis kind of brought everything full circle and tied, because when I started, because the diastasis, it's always like fixing your diastasis. It's the question of, what are you trying to fix? Are you trying to improve function? Are you trying to improve appearance? Are you trying to fit a certain aesthetic? Because the whole snapback culture is really about fitting a certain aesthetic. And so in trying to kind of figure out my diastasis, I also had to figure out like what I was looking for. And I had to be honest with myself about what I was looking for and what aesthetic that I was trying to fit. And when we're showing images of postpartum bodies or strong bodies or in the health magazines, I started buying a lot of fitness magazines. Mm-hmm. It is predominantly white. And so I'm looking at white bellies. I'm looking at white fit pose. I'm looking at white women and white bodies. And I had to, and part of my struggle throughout my whole life is comparing my black body to a white body, which it was not, and trying to find beauty by making myself closer to whiteness, by making my proximity closer to whiteness. It came from everything, like how I did my hair. As a child, my mom always used to braid my hair. She used to do a style in Nigeria called threading. And I got bullied about that. People said that my hair looked like snakes, that my hair was snakes, that my hair was spiders. And so I would take it out and started chemically straightening my afro so it would fall down like European hair. I started like wearing wigs so it would look more European. And so when I was a kid, I would buy foundation that was two or three shades lighter than me. My mom's a lighter skin tone than me, or I would wear my mom's foundation so my skin would appear lighter. I wouldn't sit out in the sun with my friends because I'm already dark skinned and I didn't want to get darker. For a while, I bought blue contact lenses. And so I realized part of my life, I've been chasing beauty because in my idea, beauty was proximity to whiteness, which isn't just me, because that's what we're taught in life. And going through my postpartum journey, it was something that almost became highlighted to me with diastasis. Like, what is normal? I came into this diastasis with a hernia, with two hernias. I actually have two hernias that sit above each other. So when we're talking about closing the gap, I started questioning, well, how am I going to close this gap when I have like two holes in my midline? So it's never going to close. It's never going to be 1 centimeter, because that's impossible when the holes are like 3 centimeters. And then I thought about what my belly looked like before. How far was the separation? What distance was my linear elbow? What standard am I trying to reach for my body? And that was kind of, and that's also what's brought up my realizations in the way that race and racism and white supremacy and anti-blackness affects body image. And a lot of the things that we associate with physical fitness actually have nothing at all to do with physical health. When we're talking about body size, the demonization of big bodies was really the demonization of black bodies, because in the transatlantic slavery and the antebellum period, the value of black women was really in their ability to reproduce. If you were a person was born to an enslaved woman, they were automatically a slave. Your slavery heritage was according to your mother. And so enslaved women were having multiple children. It wasn't uncommon for them to have 10, 12, 13 children. So imagining enslaved women, a lot of them had postpartum bodies. A lot of them were having extra weight. A lot of them were in this perinatal phase. And a lot of them were wet nurses and mammies, and the white women were encouraged to separate themselves from the appearance of these enslaved women by like losing the weight, by being slim, by being put together. And so we look at dieting. Dieting came out of modern day dieting is first attributed to the Grahamites, who took up dieting as a way to separate themselves from black and indigenous people. Sylvester Graham believed that the rich foods of black and indigenous people led to sexual immorality. And so he's like attributed with the Graham cracker. He just thought that taking away heavy seasonings from food and taking away the richness from food would prevent people from being sexually promiscuous, from being immoral. And so that eating habits, and when I think about the way the Grahamites eat, I actually think about like this idea of clean eating, or when you look at dieting and it's just like plain chicken with no seasoning, this very like bland food. That was the way that he did it. And it was nothing to do with body size. It was all about to do with moral superiority. And so going through my diastasis, the journey and seeing my body get stronger and seeing myself be able to do the things I was told I wasn't, but also not seeing my body look the way that I expected it to look. I had to have some honest conversations about myself, about what I was chasing and whose body I was chasing and whose body I was viewing as normal.
Yeah, I'd be interested to, I wonder if you'd had children in Nigeria and had a diastasis, do you think, I never know, but do you think it would have bothered you as much? Is it such an issue for the aesthetics of diastasis that you're aware of in Nigeria?
Yeah, I wonder that too, because now obviously modern day beauty standards affect everyone. But I've had had a conversation with an Indian friend that said she talked to her mother about diastasis and her mother has like no recollection of it. And she's like, but she said, I also know that the women in my family, the older women, they have bellies that are a bit bigger, but it was seen as normal. It wasn't something that was seen as that your belly shouldn't look like this. I mean, I remember I was in the shower just the other day and I bent over and I saw all this skin hanging down. I was just like, in my head, I was like, whoa, like, I'm old is what I actually thought. I've definitely had three babies.
You're definitely not old.
But I think that's funny because that's something that everyone can relate to, because, like, I think that idea of what is normal and who sets this benchmark and who decided the standard is so key, because even if I think of the predominantly white population coming into me, the majority of women are coming postpartum. They may have diastasis, they may not, but they're coming in. And when it's coming to assessment, there nearly has to be a conscious cue to let go. Like, women are holding their tummy in all the time because they think that this is more aesthetically pleasing. And it's something I'm like, when did this come? Because like if we even think of just general anatomy and think of it logically, we're made to round up from the pubic bone. We have organs in there. We're made to have a abdominal wall that distends so that it can accommodate for digestion, for wind, for any changes in that region. And like, where did this idea that it should stay static and stay completely flat and washboard, why did that become aesthetically pleasing? Because I think there's a huge reframing that needs to go on across the board. What I'm really interested from you in Emicit is to, you've kind of said about one of the things being representation. So obviously we need more diverse representation throughout all societies so that we can have more awareness of the normal variances. But what needs a change? Like in 2021, almost 2022, we're having a conversation that, gosh, I'm hearing you speak, you can see me and Emma are, it's nearly embarrassing to be associated with any part of society that has caused this sort of infliction onto fellow peers. Like, because I would see any of us who are humans are the same. Like, we're just humans. Like, so what needs to change? What can we do? What message can we put out there to instigate change, and what needs to happen?
What message can I think a big thing when dealing with people one-on-one, with clients one-on-one, it's important to have context and also not to compare them, with themselves, to compare them with their experience, and also to get an understanding of their expectations. But I was just thinking too with diastasis and how it presents, and whether people of different, you know, ethnic backgrounds or cultural backgrounds notice it. There's also the aspect of like prehab and rehab and treatment during that period. Like my mother talks about when she went through her pregnancy, she had two of her pregnancies in Nigeria. And there was, traditionally, there's this idea of a fattening room. So it's for 4 months after you have your child, you're in a fattening room, which is just in your home, and women bring you food, your food is cooked for you, your belly is binded, you're looked after, and the idea is that you don't have to do anything. You look after your baby at home and everybody else services you. And so there's this focus on postpartum care. And then when we look at kind of the history of modern gynecology, when white doctors saw that there was money to be made in obstetrics and gynecology, they started trying to discredit the people that were doing the work at the time. And in the 18th and 19th century, it was Black and Indigenous people that were the midwives that were delivering babies, that were looking after pregnant women. And in order to promote hospitals and to promote hospital care and to get women to come to hospitals, white doctors of the time did a lot of discrediting. They discredited midwives and suggested that home births were less safe, that hospital births were the way, and that these medical interventions were the safest way to deliver a baby. And so in that, we've had a lot of traditional knowledge lost because of that. A lot of the knowledge that the first midwives came over from the African slave ships. So a lot of the information that these Black midwives and these Indigenous midwives have been lost. And so I think about the aspect of approaching diastasis from a point of care. And so when we're in this snapback culture, when the idea is have a baby and just be able to do everything that you had before the baby, and then there's no honoring this postpartum period of healing and this period of like just letting your body recover. And some of the challenges I find when people think the challenge is diastasis, it's not always the diastasis or the gap or the hernia. It's just you had a baby, you haven't recovered physiologically. There's a lot that still needs to recover from this. And yeah, and so I think there's that information that's missing, this really how to take in knowledge from other communities and honoring the knowledge of other communities. And I just think about how I felt about my hernia personally, when my grandmother said to my parents that there was nothing wrong with me and the surgery was unnecessary. For years, I just thought she just didn't know. She just doesn't understand. She didn't understand in Nigeria that it wasn't. It's only as an adult now that I'm like realizing that she was a woman that grew up around children that look like me. She'd seen generations of children that look like me. She'd seen people in my family that look like me. And so to her, I was normal. And she'd seen these hernias resolve itself, and she'd seen that it wasn't problematic. And her knowledge and her experience was valid versus this. My dad was a doctor, a highly respected pediatrician. It's not like I got some surgery in a back alley. It was someone who had studied for years, and I assumed he must know better. But I also didn't consider that he was educated in a medical system that came out of the transatlantic slave trade, a medical system that came out of antebellum slavery, a medical system that has a lot of biases sewn into it. And that also he might just not have experienced a person like me. He might not have ever dealt with a Black child. And so to me, for him, my hernia was abnormal. And what I know now as an adult is that the research shows that around 30% of children of African descent are born with umbilical hernias. And so it's actually fairly common with children of African descent, but it's not as common with children of European descent. And so if you don't have the information and if you don't have the representation and you don't know what you don't know. And so I've just realized as an adult now, it's important to seek different sources of information and not to disregard knowledge from other places because you think of it as, just because it's not presented the same way, you think of the knowledge as inferior because the way that people have been taught to like respect and listen to white men and not listen to women, basically.
Yeah, and we need to really change the narrative, re-educate, and also have role models like yourself. I mean, what you're doing is incredibly empowering for all women, but you must be building quite an incredible community from your social media, and the feedback must be nothing but positive for the messages that you give to women.
Yeah, and I found, because the big thing is, I mean, if you seek rights and want representation for like the lowest group, then you're going to get it for everyone. Like if you uplift Black women, you uplift all women. The things that are good for Black women, like honoring Black women's, like paying attention to Black women's pain, listen to Black women. And because it's not just Black women that report that they're not taken seriously by doctors, it's all women. But it's like, if you can focus on these really oppressed populations, then it really benefits everyone. And like, even when we talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, the rebuttal was All Lives Matter. And the Black Lives Matter movement didn't suggest that all lives matter. It's basically adding a two. It's saying Black Lives Matter too. And if you can honor, like, if you can look at the way Black people are treated and advocate for equal treatment of Black people, that is advocating for equal treatment of all people. It's like bringing us all up to the same level. And so really, like, when I speak about my personal experiences, it's not unique to Black women, it's just a lot more common for Black women. And so if we address these things, we're addressing it for all women.
I think that some of the key things to check out, if anyone's listening and you haven't come across an Emma's social media profiles, there's some great reels and things too. And I think you have a really creative way of getting the message out there. It's very inspiring. And do you know what? The take-home message in some of them is just so clear. There was a few I was looking at recently, even just, I'm not sure, it was, you were dressing up in some of your traditional clothing by the end of it. It was absolutely stunning. I was going to say, and that's the thing too, that I want to mention out there, because, you know, so much of what we heard is about how you don't feel like you fitted in growing up, how you were based in standards and objectives for aesthetics and beauty on white society, whereas I think Emma and I are sitting here thinking, oh my gosh, she looks amazing. Me and Emma always talk about how people look, like, your skin is amazing. And it's just funny the different perceptions that people can have. So I don't know, I just think there's so much needs to change. I think this is a really important conversation. I think it really lends to the conversation that we commenced on this topic in season one. And I really hope that, do you know what? I really hope that we can have you on to the podcast again, maybe in a year's time, and that things will have changed and moved on a little bit, and we'll be progressing conversations to some degree. But I know that Emma always wraps up podcasts with her. I'm going to let Emma do it. It's your role, Emma. You take it.
Thanks, Gronja, for that. We always like to finish our podcast by asking our experts that we interview if they can offer us any tips on how they might suggest women manage their pelvic health or their body image issues or perhaps diastasis. So I wonder, can you offer our listeners three tips from you, please?
Tip one is let it go. That's the most common thing that I come across. Your belly is supposed to distend. You don't have to.
Good work. Well done.
What you can do for your pelvic health is just to let your belly relax. Option two is that normal is subjective. My 10-year-old son says everybody has a different way of being normal. And so just because you're not like someone else, it doesn't make you abnormal. And the third tip is to always advocate for yourself. And so if you feel that something's not right and you're not being heard, the problem is not you. The problem is the person that you're speaking to. And so always speak up until you find somebody that's willing to listen.
Love it.
Awesome. So much better said than asked. Thank you so, so much for joining us. Well, for us this afternoon, for you this morning, is it the morning?
Yeah. 8:20 now.
Oh, it's just been amazing to speak to you, and really excited to watch your journey, because I think massive things are going to come from you. So we can claim that we had you on our podcast and feel very proud. So thank you ever so much. We really, really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, Emma. Thanks both for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We really hope you enjoyed it. We always love to hear your feedback and any questions you might have. So please do contact us via Instagram @yourcervix_thepodcast or Twitter @yourcervix_PM. Don't forget to check out our wonderful sponsor, Pelvic Relief. You can find them at www.pelvicrelief.co.uk. Gronja and I really look forward to catching up with you next week.